Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back for Hour 2 of Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And we continue this hour with our open forum internet version. That is, we're trying to answer all the questions the internet has about the Catholic faith, about Catholic life, morals, all the questions in that area. So we're not taking calls this hour because we do get lots of these internet inquiries, and we want to take at least some time from time to time to make sure we clear as much of the backlog as we can, because it's during the regular open forums, we take mostly calls. And so we often have internet questions left over. Our guest this hour, Jimmy Akin, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and the senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hi, Jimmy.
How do you, Cy?
How are you this second hour?
I'm doing well.
Really?
Status has not changed a lot since the first hour.
Good. So the last 6 minutes were okay for you.
Yeah. Well, it's actually been like a couple of days since we taped the first hour.
I thought you looked different.
Well, I lost another pound, so that was good.
Hey, congratulations. Yeah. Good for you. You are going to stop this at some point before you disappear.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. You have a plan of action.
I do. I want to lose probably about another 35 pounds.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And at what speed? How long does it take to lose 30 or 35 pounds?
Well, it depends on how aggressive you are at it. Under normal circumstances, if you can burn about half a pound of fat a day.
You really?
Yeah. That's
if you're fasted completely.
If you're completely fasting. I'm not doing a complete fast, so I don't do that. But on average, you can lose up to about half a pound a day.
Wow. Hey, we're going to do a show sometime on fasting together, right? We'll talk about the religious aspects and the physiological aspects and all that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. That's coming up. You, as I said, are the author of A Daily Defense, and each page of the book is another day. And I randomly select a question for you, and I want to do that now, day 69.
Okay.
Jesus said at the end of the end of the world, this generation will not pass away before all these things take place. But Jesus' generation died, and the end of the world has not happened. Therefore, Jesus prophesied falsely, and so he can't be God.
Yeah. So there are a number of different places in the Gospels where Jesus makes statements like this. In this case, he's speaking in the context of what's known as the Olivet Discourse. This is a speech he's reported as having given on the Mount of Olives during Holy Week. And so the Mount of Olives is right across the Kidron Valley from Jerusalem, and they're very close together. So if you're standing on the Mount of Olives, you just look west, there's Jerusalem, and specifically there's the Temple Mount. And that's why it's important we read this statement in context, because the reason that he gave the Olivet Discourse is they'd just been visiting the temple, which was something they did on a daily basis during Holy Week. And as they were coming out of it, some of the disciples were remarking on how glorious the temple looked. These huge stones and stuff, and it's very beautiful. And in fact, we know from historical sources outside the gospel that was true. I mean, archaeologically, you know, we have some of the remains of the temple, and indeed they have these massive, I mean, tens of tons stones. They're huge.
Yeah.
And we also, in addition to the archaeology, we know from the Jewish historian Josephus a lot about how the temple was appointed and the kinds of furnishings it had and the kinds of tapestries and the colors. And it was apparently gorgeous. It had a kind of white appearance with some gold overlay, so it shone in the sun. And according to the rabbis in the Talmud, if you had not seen the temple in Jerusalem, according to them, you had not seen a beautiful building. And so it was a fantastic looking building. It was very impressive. The disciples are coming out of it going, wow, isn't this an amazing temple? And Jesus says, well, you see these stones? They're all going to be torn down. And so So that's what he said. And the disciples, you know, wanted a little more information. And so they said, well, tell us, you know, when is this going to be? What's going to be the sign of it happening? And in response, Jesus gave the Olivet Discourse. And now, in Mark's version, which is the earliest of the versions we have recorded, it's in Mark 13. And the only thing the disciples ask about is when is this going to happen and what's going to be the sign that it's about to happen? Because in you know, if God's temple is going to be destroyed, presumably God's going to give us a sign to let us know when that's going to happen. And so Jesus lays out a number of things. He says, you know, here are some things that are going to happen, but these are not the sign. And then he identifies and he talks about the intervening time period where it's going to be a time of witness and you're going to have some persecution, but the end is not yet. And then he says, but when you see the abomination of desolation, flee to the mountains. And that's the sign. It's the appearance of the abomination of desolation, which is based on the book of Daniel. It has some echoes in the book of Maccabees. Luke, in his version, translates that for us and explains in his, instead of referring to the abomination of desolation, he says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. So that's the key. The temple's about to be destroyed when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, and they are, or they bring, the abomination of desolation. And Jesus says, you know, nobody's going to know exactly when this is going to be. This is something God has kept to himself, but it's going to happen within this generation. And all these prophecies he's just given are going to be fulfilled in that 40-year period. So Jesus is saying this in Holy Week of AD 33. Biblical generation could be estimated as being about 40 years long. That would take us up to AD 73. The temple was destroyed in AD 70. So it actually happened just like he said. Now, I should mention in Matthew's account of this, they ask an additional question, which is what's going to be the sign of your coming. And Matthew's version, unlike Mark's and Luke's, also has some additional material appended at the end, like the parable of the sheep and the goats and the 10 wise virgins. That's not in Mark or Luke. And these parables do seem to deal with the coming of Jesus Christ. So it looks like in Matthew's version, he not only recorded the prophecies connected with the destruction of the temple, but then also some prophecies about the second coming. But he doesn't say that's going to happen in this generation. What he applies that to is the destruction of the temple.
And Matthew, that's pretty common that he collects various sayings to make a discourse out of them that come from different places.
Yeah, at least that's the way it appears. In Luke, you find a lot of little statements here and there that in Matthew have been gathered up and put together, like, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount. If you look in Luke, there's a kind of sermon called the Sermon on the Plain that's a lot like the Sermon on the Mount, but it's not nearly as long. But then in the Sermon on the Mount, we have the Sermon on the Plain material and a bunch of other stuff that looks like it's been drawn in from other passages. Although I should mention there's a rival theory here. According to some people's views, this is a position known as the Farrar theory, the Farrar hypothesis. Luke used Matthew and hated long discourses and tore them apart in order to not have such long periods without forward momentum in the narrative.
Yeah.
And that, so there are people out there who think that the kind of retort is that if once you've got Matthew's beautiful discourses, why would Luke want to unscramble the egg with such a vengeance?
Yeah, right. It's like, yeah, it'd be like breaking apart one of Shakespeare's soliloquies or something.
Yeah.
Is it also true that now the temple's destroyed in 70 AD, is it true that the gold of the temple was used by the Romans to pay for the construction of the Colosseum?
I'd want to do some checking to validate that specific claim. What they did do is they took a lot of gold from the temple.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the temple, when it got burned, you know, the gold melted, and there were also gold, there were gold coins and stuff in storage at the temple because they didn't have banks exactly back then. And so a lot of rich people would store their wealth in the temple. And so the Romans got all of that and they got the temple furnishings and they brought them back to Rome for a triumph. And today, if you look near – it's not right there, but it's real near the Colosseum. There's an arch known as Titus's Arch. Titus was the temple, was the general who was there supervising the war at the destruction of the temple. So when Titus comes back, he's the son of the new emperor Vespasian. He gets a triumph, which is a special kind of military celebration the Romans would have. And they would lead captives that they had taken captive from the war, including, I want to say, Simon Bar Giora was one of these. It was one of the three rebel leaders from the Zealot party that they brought back to Jerusalem, back to Rome from Jerusalem. And if you look on Titus's arch, they have bas-reliefs of the people bringing back the temple treasures. And they've got right there the menorah from the Jewish temple depicted on Titus's arch. So they got the menorah. They brought it back. They brought back Torah scrolls. They brought back a number of other things. They had the big triumph. And then they threw, I believe it was Simon Bar Giora, they threw him right off the big rock that they have in Rome to execute him to show this is what happens if you're a traitor to Rome.
Yeah, they like to teach that lesson
frequently.
Well, open forum today with Jimmy Akin, but the open forum is of an internet variety. We have a whole bunch of questions from folks who have contacted us either via email or through the various social media sites, Facebook and whatnot. We will get to those when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live. Catholic Answers Live is on EWTN Television.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Join me for a show dedicated to Catholic apologetics and evangelization as we connect viewers to prominent leaders in the church today and touch on just about everything relating to the church. Doctrinal issues, family concerns, social issues, evangelization, ethics, you name it.
Catholic Answers Live TV, Friday night, 5:30 Eastern on EWTN Television.
Are you coming to the Catholic Answers Conference this September?
You guys put on a great show, so it's well worth coming.
Very powerful, very motivational and moving.
I think it's awesome. It's been really amazing to get to know people from all across the country.
Every time somebody's speaker finishes, I feel like I want to cry just because of how happy I am.
It's been pretty phenomenal. Very educational, enlightening.
This year's conference is September 28th through the 30th here in beautiful San Diego, and we want to see you there. Seats are still available, but act now because they are going fast. Call us today at 1-888-291-8000 or visit CatholicAnswersConference.com now and reserve your spot.
This is where it starts, and it definitely has started for me.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Internet open forum today, taking all of our questions from the various internet venues but from which we might get questions. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, our guest. And you, Jimmy.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up. During the break, I checked, and it was indeed Simon Bar Giora, who was the Jewish rebel leader that they threw from the Tarpeian Rock in Rome. The Tarpeian Rock is kind of interesting. It's a kind of a cliff, and that's there. You know, Rome is built on hills, and one of them on the Capitoline Hill, it has this cliff known as the Tarpeian Rock. And once I was in Rome, and I was, you know, walking around the Capitoline Hill, and I needed a break, so I sat down for a few minutes, just looking around. I was looking at this big cliff, looked it up later, did not realize it at the time, but that was the Tarpeian Rock.
And lots of executions there.
Yeah. In fact, it's in like the 12 tables of Rome, you know, which were their early law code.
Yeah.
If so-and-so does X, let him be hurled from the Tarpeian Rock.
Uh-huh.
And I've always thought, you know, if I write a science fiction novel at some point on an alien world, I'm going to have some equivalent of the Tarpeian Rock, you know, that's like written into their law code.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, this is, you shove them off this.
Asteroid.
If they've done a certain crime. But it's right next to, since it's on the Capitoline Hill, it's right next to the temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus, or Jupiter Best and Greatest. Jupiter being the Roman equivalent of Zeus, and he was, you know, kind of their major deity. He was the head of their pantheon. And you had asked about, was the gold from the temple used to build the Colosseum? And I'd have to check that. But what I do know is after AD 70, after the Jewish defeat, the Romans imposed a tax on Jewish people all over the empire called the Fiscus Judaicus, the Jewish tax. And the proceeds from that, as a form of humiliation, were used to support the temple of Jupiter Best and Greatest in Rome.
Uh-huh.
So they were taking this tax money and using it to support the temple of a pagan god, which would just totally irk Jews.
Right. It's kind of a mockery of their monotheism.
Rubbing their face in this.
Yeah.
So that's all I have to say about that, except for the fact that Jupiter Optimus Maximus sounds like a member of the Transformers.
I was going to ask if he might be related to Optimus Prime. Are there any named Maximus?
Among the Transformers, I don't know. I'm not really familiar.
Jupiter Optimus Prime. Well, let's go to internet questions. Catherine, Jimmy from the internet asks, my 18-year-old son is going through this doubting God phase, and we have had many talks about it. Yes. I have a lot of Catholic resources and have backed up my position with them, as well as pray daily for his faith. His main current argument is that from Descartes, we can't know the world. Well, we can't know the world is just a matrix-like place, and also that it hasn't ever been proven that nothing existed before something existed.
Okay. So it's not uncommon for young people to go through a questioning period. That frequently happens as they make that shift from, you know, having been mostly just having been taught their faith to personally appropriating it and understanding it and you know, asking questions and getting the answers. So that's a kind of normal transitional phase. Lots of young people go through that. And in this case, he's obviously an intellectually engaged young man. He knows about Descartes, for example. For people in the audience who may not know about Descartes, René Descartes was a Frenchman who lived a few hundred years ago. He was a mathematician and a philosopher, and he wrote a series of discourses called his Meditations on First Philosophy. I actually used to teach these when I was a grad student in philosophy. I'd teach these as part of my courses, so I'm quite familiar with the text. Basically, what Descartes does in his Meditations is he says, and in modern terms, what he's trying to do is use a theory of knowledge known as foundationalism. The idea in foundationalism is you start with a particular set of beliefs that are firm.
Yes.
And these are the foundation that you then go on to build other beliefs on, and hopefully if you've got a firm foundation, then the rest of the beliefs you build on those will also be firm. And so in the first part of the Meditations, what Descartes does is he says, well, let's try to make the firmest foundation we can by applying a method of systematic doubt. So if anything can be doubted, I'm going to set it aside and say it's not part of our foundation. We can't trust that. And then once we found a rock solid foundation, we'll try to rebuild the structure of our knowledge from there, and we'll have confidence that it's been rebuilt in a way we can have confidence in. because it's on a firm foundation. So he starts suggesting all kinds of different things. He has some kind of neat examples. Like he'll say, imagine I'm looking out my window and I see people passing in the street below, but how do I know they're really people? How do I know that they're not like – and he didn't have the word robot because it hadn't been invented yet. But how do I know they're not like mechanisms, you know, under – with a run by affairs of springs under people's clothing? So I'm just seeing their hats and stuff moving. And so basically, how do I know they're not robots? He goes on to start doubting sense experience. And, you know, so any – how can I trust my senses? And he didn't have this example. He's a kind of Descartes-esque example that a lot of people have used is, how do I know I'm not a brain in a vat? Or to deal in this case with Catherine's son, how do we know we're not in a matrix?
Yeah.
And so he ultimately concludes that there is one thing he can be absolutely sure of. He knows he's thinking, and because he's doing all this reasoning about, you know, can I trust this or that? So he's thinking. And if he's thinking, he must exist. And so he takes as his foundation cogito ergo sum. I think, or I should say it the Latin way, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. And he then tries to rebuild his structure of knowledge on that basis. The problem is, or one of the problems is, people have agreed that Descartes was pretty successful in applying systematic doubt to everything and reducing, you know, down to a very small number of beliefs. But two problems. First problem, he may not have gone far enough. Other people have suggested maybe even I think therefore I am is too much. Maybe
really?
It should be I think therefore there is a thought.
Oh.
How do you know it entails you? Or if this is only a possible world, not the actual one, I think, therefore, there is the possibility of a thought.
That's pretty
That's pretty minimal.
Yeah.
Second problem, even if you give him cogito ergo sum, people have agreed that his attempt to rebuild the structure of knowledge is not as successful as his attempt to tear it down.
Right.
And this has led a lot of people to a conclusion that I would recommend in this situation, which is foundationalism is not the way to go. If you start by trying to tear down everything using systematic doubt, you will end up basically knowing and believing nothing, or next to nothing. Skepticism is an acid that will, if you apply it systematically, make it impossible for you to live your life, because you cannot apply this system of skepticism universally in your life, because you would never know, is the law of gravity going to work when I try to get up out of bed?
Mm-hmm.
Are my muscles going to do what I think? Are they going to contract in the right way, or will they set off a nuclear explosion?
Yeah.
You know, will it kill me if I try to get out of bed? Maybe my food's poisoned. I shouldn't eat anything because it could be poisoned. It could kill me. It could have bacteria. I'm going to get sick and die. You know, there's if you think about all the alternatives that could hypothetically be true, it will effectively destroy your life. And so this kind of hyper-skeptical approach is not the way to work. We don't say in other areas of life, let's apply systematic doubt until we can prove that something is true. And we shouldn't be doing it in life in general, because it's fundamentally not how we're designed by God, by evolution, whatever you want to say. It's not how we're designed to operate in our environment. We have to have a certain basic level of trust in our senses and our ability to know things. And while asking questions and applying, you know, critical reasoning is a useful tool, it's not the only tool we need. Sometimes faith and reason have been compared to the two shoes on your feet. You get farther with both than you do with just one. And certainly if you're applying skepticism universally and not ever trusting anything, then it will destroy your life. You'd be better off actually just trusting ordinary stuff and going with that. And so I would say that the Cartesian enterprise is fundamentally flawed in this respect. And so whether it comes to God or whether it comes to other things in your life, that kind of hyper-skeptical approach is not what you'd use anywhere else, and so you shouldn't use it in religion either. In terms of the specific claim about, well, we can't prove this isn't a matrix-like environment, maybe we're all living in a simulation, well, okay, sure, can't prove that. I can't prove that. I can't prove I'm not dreaming right now. I mean, I know I have dreams. I know that I have this simulated world in my head every night when I go to sleep. And at the time, I can't prove that I'm dreaming. I can't prove right now that I'm not dreaming. But it doesn't matter because this is the reality I have. This is the reality I have to deal with. And so it doesn't matter if I'm in a matrix-like simulation or not. This is the life I have to live, and I need to interact with my environment and survive and thrive as it is.
Thank you very much, Catherine, for that question. Internet open forum today. Thanks for letting me be in your dream today, Jimmy. We'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Christian men, beware. With the idols of materialism, entertainment, and the flesh, it's plain to see that the world wants you for its own. Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Lessons to Young Men About Life, Sex, Friendship, Vocation, and Loving with the Heart of Christ, Father Ehrman draws on his experiences counseling men who are struggling to live in the world, but not be of the world. In a unique format, he offers a plan for ongoing conversion, holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Be a part of Mother Angelica's mission. EWTN Radio is seeking a dynamic producer to join our growing radio team. The EWTN radio producer is responsible for managing all aspects of live and recorded programs, develops program ideas consistent with EWTN's mission, and collaborates with the leading voices in Catholic radio. For all the details about this exciting opportunity, click on employment at EWTN.com.
Second hour, Catholic Answers Live, Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, Senior Apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest. And Jimmy, just as we went to the break, you were finishing addressing a question from Catherine.
Yeah.
Her son apparently doesn't want to believe in things because he's not sure he doesn't live in a matrix. But there was another part of that.
Yeah.
And that has to do with, he says, it hasn't ever been proven that nothing existed before something existed.
Okay, so there may be a misunderstanding here. Nothing is by definition is not a thing, and so it's not true from a Catholic point of view that nothing existed and then there was something, that there was a time when there was nothing. Because if there was a time, even if there wasn't any physical matter yet, then there would have been time.
And that's not nothing.
And that's not nothing. Time is something. And so the idea isn't that there was a time when there was nothing that was before everything that exists. The claim really is that everything which exists, including space and time, only goes back so far. And that that if you were heading back in space and time, there would be a stop point where you can't go beyond that point because there is no more space or time to go into beyond that point. So that's really what the claim is. And in terms of that, well, if you say it hasn't been proved, well, you have to say, well, what do you mean by proof? If you mean it hasn't been proved mathematically that it was the just absolute logical certitude that this is the case, well, you have an argument there. Now, some philosophers will actually say they think you can prove this, that they'll say there can't be an infinite regress of historical causes. Personally, I don't agree with that. I agree with Thomas Aquinas that if God wanted to, he could have made an infinite regress of historical causes. But other people disagree with that. However, that kind of rigorous mathematical proof style that we might like is often something that's not achievable. And one field, a big field that a lot of people respect today, where it's not achievable is science. Scientific method does not give you mathematical certitude that things are true. Instead, science looks at evidence and says, well, based on the evidence we have, what does the evidence suggest? And we're going to go with that. And when you turn to contemporary science and say, well, does it look like space and time had a beginning? The answer is yes. The evidence we have suggests that all of the universe of space and time and matter and energy began in a dramatic event about 13.8 billion years ago that we call the Big Bang. And we don't have evidence at this point for anything happening before the Big Bang. Now, we haven't proved that there's nothing before the Big Bang. There could be, and one day we could discover evidence of that. But at the moment, we don't have such evidence. And so at the moment, science actually points in the direction of there being a beginning to everything. So that's a point worth considering. Again, you know, in a lot of these areas, it's a question of how much of the acid of skepticism are you going to use versus how much of the evidence at hand are you going to look at? Because you can always imagine there's evidence you don't have to contradict the evidence you do have. But that's not proceeding in a rational, balanced way. The rational, balanced way is going to focus on the evidence you do have and not worry about evidence that you don't have and that may not even exist. By the way, one other thing I'd mention real quickly for Catherine, there's a book that you might want to consider getting your son. It's called The Handbook of Catholic Apologetics. It's by Peter Kraft and Ronald Ticelli, and it has lots of information on arguments for the existence of God, positive ones. I haven't even today tried offering a positive argument for the existence of God, but you'll find a bunch of them in the Handbook of Catholic Apologetics, as well as other helpful information supporting the Catholic faith.
Thank you again, Catherine. We go now to a question from Andy, also from the internet, because this is an internet open forum all day today. I have a question about Dungeons and Dragons. I have some middle schoolers interested in starting a Dungeons and Dragons club. I grew up with tell me RPGs again.
Well, it's either rocket-propelled grenade
I know
or
it's not that.
Role-playing game.
Oh, yeah, role-playing games. Okay.
By the way, when I was when I was younger and I did a lot of role-playing games, and I even did design work in role-playing games, I knew a guy who was a Vietnam vet who designed a role-playing game called RPG after a rocket-propelled grenade because they used them in Vietnam.
And RPG was an RPG.
Yeah.
So this gentleman says, I grew up with role-playing games, and he wants the kids to have fun with their adventurous minds. Would Dungeons & Dragons be appropriate for middle schoolers? And he's leery of it because of how the games may not have the best morals, and the name Dungeons and Dragons evokes thoughts, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that might contradict the Catholic faith or might seem to contradict the Catholic faith.
Okay. This is a question that requires prudence. There's not an up or down rule here. Dungeons and Dragons is not intrinsically evil. I have had a lot of experience with it in my younger days, and it's a fantasy game. It involves, you know, it involves magic and things like that, and imaginary mythological characters sometimes and things like that. It's not different, though, in those regards than Tolkien's Lord of the Rings or C.S. Lewis's Narnia. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the same kind of magical fantasy worlds that incorporate, let's say, you know, satyrs from Greek mythology or whatever. And so there's not an intrinsic problem. Now, having said that there's not an intrinsic problem, that doesn't mean there's no problem. It really depends a lot on the person who's running the game. In role-playing games, in Dungeons & Dragons in particular, that person is called a dungeon master. In other games, it's called a game master. But it's the person who's running the game, because that person is responsible for the story that gets created in the game and is responsible for controlling what happens in the game, including what the players are and are not allowed to do. And I've seen a lot of game environments where the game master is incorporating or allowing the players to incorporate morally problematic stuff.
I see.
And so if you had a game master who was able to keep things on an even keel morally, it could be fine. But if you have a game master who's not doing that, then it becomes a problem very quickly. So that's what I'd have to say about that. Now, something that you could do is look at some other games, either other fantasy games, other role-playing games, or other games in other genres. For example, there are superhero games. Mm-hmm. You know, like you could, there's a DC superhero game, there's a Marvel superhero game. There are actually several of different superhero games. And, you know, you could use that kind of imaginative setup for the world play that you want the kids to have. You know, superhero stuff has an orientation towards virtue.
Right.
And it's easier, you know, to kind of keep that on a morally even keel than it might be the kind of Dungeons and Dragons type environment. There are others as well. There are also card games. There are a lot of tabletop games that people play these days. So I would just say do some research. Go down to a local game shop and talk to some people. Check out some games. You could even visit some sessions and see what you think might be an appropriate form of play that, you know, wouldn't infringe on parental sensibilities. And that's something I wanted to stress here, because Andy mentioned this taking place in the context of a school, and different parents are going to have different sensibilities about what's okay for their kids. And so we always want to make sure that we're respecting parental sensibilities.
Right. Indeed. Right. Andy, thank you very much for that question. You don't know of any specifically like a Catholic role-playing game or something that
I don't. Not no. That's published. I haven't been active in the gaming community in a long time, I'm afraid.
Janie, also from the internet, asks, my sister says she has encountered the question, what would be your response to people who say the Catholic Church is misogynistic? Why is it that women are not in positions of authority in the church? There are many people that say this is proof that women are treated as second-class citizens in the church.
Well, so there are a number of things that can be said here. One of them is actually women have a lot of authority in the church. Now, they may not be priests and bishops, but just about every non-ordained position, you're going to find women not only are there, but frequently they're far more prevalent than men in terms of like parish administrators and people who run parishes and religious education directors and all kinds of people. There's a preponderance of women actually.
May I just give you a quick example of that? I was on the diocesan curia here in the Diocese of San Diego.
Some years ago.
Right. Mm-hmm. And these are the people who head departments for the diocese. And when you looked around the table at the diocesan curia, women far outnumbered men in leading departments.
Yeah.
So that's just to give you an example of that.
Yeah. So so actually, with the exception of ordained ministry, women actually are very prominent in the church. And that's not surprising, because women in general, just sociologically, certainly in our culture and in other cultures too, tend to be more religious than men. And so it's natural that they would be more active and engaged in a lot of these areas. And the church respects and honors women. The church, in fact, has documents that talk specifically about this. There was a document that came out, for example, a very famous one that came out during the pontificate of John Paul II called Dignitatis Mulieris, on the dignity of women. And if you want to go online, you can easily find that. Again, the title of that is Dignitatis Mulieris. And it could prove to be some very enlightening reasoning. In terms of, areas where there hasn't yet been haven't yet been as many women leaders as you might expect. Like, let's say, now you mentioned here at a local diocesan curia, women tend to be the majority in terms of department heads. That's not the case of the Vatican at this point. Most of the Vatican departments are headed by archbishops or cardinals, and so that means ordained ministry. But there have been discussions in recent years about, well, not all of these departments necessarily need to be headed by an archbishop or a cardinal, and some of them could be headed by lay people, including women. And so there have been like women religious who have begun to be promoted to very significant offices over at the Vatican. And I would expect that's a historical process that would continue. Ultimately, we have to deal with the question of ordained ministry. And this is something where it's not because the church hates women, and that's what misogyny is.
Yeah.
Misogyny is hating women. That's the definition of the term. The church doesn't hate women, but the church also doesn't feel at liberty to change things that were given to it by its founder, Jesus Christ. Now, in the ancient world, there were priestesses. There were priestesses all over the place. Like in Rome, for example, there were the Vestal Virgins. Some of the most important priests in Rome were women. And, the various sibyls, the most important prophetesses in the ancient world were women. And so there were lots of women religious figures in the ancient world. But in establishing his church, Jesus chose to make its official leaders, initially the apostles, and they were the first priests and the first bishops, he chose to make them men. Now, why that is, that theologians have talked about. The leading theory is that, well, it's because they were to act as Jesus to other people. They were to act in persona Christi is the technical term. And since Jesus chose to incarnate as a man, he decided, according to this view, that it would be better for his official ministerial representatives to also be men. However that may be, it's his choice. He chose not to make women his church leaders, not even his own mom, who, right, on the Catholic view, far transcends any of the apostles.
Right.
And so the church feels that this is something that Jesus did, and we're bound by it, just like we're bound by other things. We can't just make up the matter we're going to use in the sacraments. You can't take the Eucharist and say we're going to use popcorn and Pepsi. You can't, take baptism and say, we're not going to use water, we're going to use sand. And so Jesus set up these sacraments, including the sacrament of the priesthood, and we're bound to accept the way he established it. There are parallels to this that people in other religious denominations and even other religions could kind of use to understand this position, because if you're religious at all, you recognize that there are some things that are just given to us as part of our religion and that we aren't in control of, that were given to us by God or the gods, and we have to do their will if we want to follow them. We can't just make stuff up and pretend we're doing their will. In the Protestant community, they don't have the sacrament of the priesthood, but they do believe in the Bible. And so what the Bible says for them is a given, just like it is for us. It's something given to us by God. We may have questions about how do we understand it, what's the right way to understand it, but fundamentally, we can't just set it aside. It's part of the givenness of Christianity and Judaism for the Hebrew Bible. And so if you're from a religious perspective at all, you should be able to recognize some things are just a given and we have to accept those. And this is one where the Catholic Church, not because it hates women, because it doesn't hate women. It cherishes both men and women. But based on the decisions made by Jesus, this is part of the given that we have to accept as Catholics, and so we do. Ultimately, though, both men and women are equal before God. This is something that is explicitly stressed in the New Testament. St. Paul talks about how in Christ there is no Jew, no Gentile, no male, no female. So in terms of our fundamental equality, now it doesn't mean there are no differences between Jews and Gentiles, and it doesn't mean there are no differences between men and women, but it does mean that in terms of how much we're valued by God and loved for God and how much he's going to be active in our lives, there's no difference between any of these categories, male, female, Jew, Gentile, slave, free. We are all equal before God.
And Janie, I hope that helps. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
It may be true for you, but not for me. How often have you heard this during a discussion with friends or family? Whether talking about faith, morality, politics, or just the basic notion of truth, so many people are captive to the notion of relativism, the belief that reality is something we decide. In his new audio presentation, Your Truth, My Truth, apologist Carlo Broussard breaks down this intellectual cancer, looking at the different kinds of relativism we regularly encounter and demonstrating how, ultimately, they collapse under the weight of their own incoherence. More importantly, Carlo makes a powerful case for the existence of objective truth, showing you how to explain to others that right and wrong are both real and universal, because it was designed that way by God. Order your copy of Your Truth, My Truth by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Mark 6:17, during a gala birthday banquet, the daughter of Herod's sister-in-law turned wife, Herodias, performed a dance that greatly pleased him. He then promised to give her whatever she asked for. Her mother told her to ask for the head of John the Baptist. The king was deeply distressed over this, for he respected John, but he had made the promise. So John's life was terminated over what seems to have been such a mere trifle. His death was a reminder to Jesus that now the preparation for his coming was past and his own death was drawing near, a death seemingly no less senseless, and yet the event that was to eclipse the grandeur of the very creation of all that is, a death that means eternal life for you and me. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Open Forum, the Internet edition. We're just taking questions from the Internet and addressing those today. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest. And I need you to help someone with about to have a tremendous headache, Jimmy.
Okay.
She said, my head is blowing up a little over this one. Her name is Jo.
That could be good. It could be mind expanding.
Maybe that's what that means. Yeah. But she was reading a Bible commentary, and the implication of this Bible commentary is that what the Bible commentary says is that Jesus seems to be saying that when Moses – okay, I'm going to – but it's a – okay, here, I better step back a second. John 5:37, where Jesus says to the authorities that no one has ever heard or seen God, and Jesus says the same thing elsewhere. This Bible commentary says, well, that means that on Sinai, essentially, Moses didn't see God the Father, but saw God the Son, that it was Jesus himself literally there talking to Moses.
Okay.
Does that make – do you think I've addressed that question correctly?
Yeah, well, so let's start by taking a look at John 5:37, just to get the original context so I can hopefully make a more informed response. Jesus is talking to a group of people, and he says, "And the Father who sent me has himself borne witness to me. His voice you have never heard, his form you have never seen." And he doesn't here say nobody has. He says you haven't.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not exactly sure what would lead the commentator who was writing the commentary to draw the conclusion that he did about Mount Sinai. We do have – so – and this is kind of a perplexing issue because there are several different factors at play here. One of them is God by nature – and this is something Jesus tells us elsewhere – is God is spirit. So he doesn't have a body, not apart from the incarnation. And he might temporarily assume other visible forms, but they're not intrinsic to him. And so it's true that these people would not have seen God's form because he's by definition invisible. And it's also true that people in Moses' day would not have seen God in his essence. But we do have some passages where God appears to people in the Old Testament in a visible form. And there's, you know, not just on Sinai, but on other occasions too. Isaiah, in his call, when God calls him to be a prophet, he has a vision of the temple with the throne of God and God sitting in the throne. So mm-hmm. he sees God. And Moses sees God on at least a couple of different occasions. So there's a question about how to understand these. Now, one line of interpretation is that these were theophanies, that these were – a theophany is a manifestation of God in nature. And so God could have assumed a temporary visible form even though it wasn't his own. Another possibility is that this is – in these cases or in some of these cases, the prophet in question was seeing the angel of the Lord. Because if you look in the Pentateuch, in the first five books of the Bible, the angel of the Lord often seems to double for the Lord. And you see this, for example, in the sacrifice of Isaac, where the angel of the Lord speaks to Abraham from the bushes, and but then he's speaking in God's voice, saying, "You know, you have not withheld your son from me." And so there's this interesting duality between the angel of the Lord and the Lord. One theory that has been popular in some circles, originating in Jewish circles, is that these manifestations involve angels. And so you even find an echo of this in St. Paul, where St. Paul talks about how the Mosaic covenant was put into effect through angels. And since angels aren't otherwise mentioned in terms of having made that covenant, but God is, it looks like that could be St. Paul's explanation for these apparent divine appearances, that they were really angels acting on God's behalf, and so they're in some way spoken of as if they were God, mm-hmm. and that could be the explanation. There's also a particular speculation that you find in the Church Fathers, and it's still around today. You'll find biblical scholars and theologians having this same speculation today, which is that the angel of the Lord is the pre-incarnate Christ. And so that, you know, angel means messenger.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean superhuman but still created spiritual being.
Right.
It just means messenger. And so if God sent his son in pre-incarnate form as his messenger mm-hmm. on some occasions, then you could describe the pre-incarnate son as the angel or messenger of the Lord. And so the speculation that that's who Moses encountered on Sinai, I wouldn't dismiss it, but I'd also say there's a good bit of uncertainty here, and so we want to be aware of these other possibilities and not be too dogmatic about any one of them.
And so if the angel of the Lord, let's just say that we're talking about what we call angels, but mm-hmm. but the created
so created spirits. Created intellect being.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were to be a messenger for God, then the angel's sole purpose is to reveal God at that point, to reveal God's will.
When the angel is functioning as a messenger.
Yeah. Yeah. So that there's a certain way in which this – I'm losing my thought a little bit because it's very complicated what all mm-hmm. this is. But yep. I mean it's hard to grasp. But so the angel, if you're saying – oh, well
– real angel, fast.
Yeah. The angel is standing in for God, I guess.
Yeah,
that's all I
the angel is standing in for God.
Standing in for God. And so it looks like God because it's trying to be fully a revelation of God's will.
It could be.
Jimmy Akin, thanks very much for this hour. I really enjoyed it.
Likewise. Thank you, Psychellet.
And thank you, Internet. Thanks for all your questions. Please keep sending them. We enjoy doing these Internet hours where we get to take all the questions that we are not able to get to in other forms. We still didn't get to everything, but we'll never exhaust the Internet, I don't think. The Internet it transcends us.
But in the beginning of the first hour, you said we would.
We failed, Jimmy.
Oh.
We failed. A little failure.
Pray for us.
See you tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live.